This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the concept that taking medicines for an illness is like digging a well when thirsty. Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socioeconomics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chandler, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In our continuing exploration of habits and addictions, we speak with Dr. Barry Zevin, who practices healthcare for the homeless at Tom Waddell Clinic.
Recovery is impossible if you're deceased.
Fred Olerking practices detox acupuncture in Minneapolis.
How could somebody stick a needle on the top of my head and a few points on my body, and it was like somebody gave me 10 milligrams of Valium?
And Jay Erker, a former smoking yogini, about her experience with tobacco, sweets, and shopping.
A yoga wants you to be healthy. Crazy.
First, some medical news. World No Tobacco Day is once again upon us on the 31st of May, 2008. This year, the theme is Tobacco-Free Youth, Breaking the Tobacco Marketing Net. The recent Global Youth Tobacco Survey indicates that tobacco use is on the rise among adolescent girls in many countries. Much of this increase is due to aggressive marketing. The World Health Organization urged governments to protect the world's 1.8 billion young people by imposing a ban on all tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship. Recent studies prove that the more young people are exposed to tobacco advertising, the more likely they are to start smoking. Tobacco companies continue targeting young people by falsely associating use of tobacco products with qualities such as glamour, energy, and sex appeal. The World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Margaret Chan, states that a ban on all tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship is a powerful tool we can use to protect the world's youth. Since most people start smoking before the age of 18, and almost a quarter of those before the age of 10, tobacco companies market their products wherever youth can be easily accessed. But it is the developing world, home to more than 80% of the world's youth, which is most aggressively targeted by tobacco companies. Young women and girls are particularly at risk, with tobacco companies seeking to weaken cultural opposition to their products in countries where women have traditionally not used tobacco. Dr. Douglas Betcher, director of WHO's Tobacco-Free Initiative, states, "The tobacco industry employs predatory marketing strategies to get young people hooked to their addictive drug. But comprehensive advertising bans do work. Half measures are not enough," he adds. "When one form of advertising is banned, the tobacco industry simply shifts its vast resources to another channel. We urge governments to impose a complete ban to break the tobacco marketing net." On April 7, 2008, a statement was issued by World Health Organization Director General Dr. Margaret Chan on the impact of climate change on human health. Excerpts from her statement read, "Last year marked a turning point in the debate on climate change. The scientific evidence continues to mount. The climate is changing, the effects are already being felt, and human activities are a principal cause. In selecting climate change as the theme for this year's World Health Day, WHO aims to turn the attention of policymakers to some compelling evidence from the health sector. While the reality of climate change can no longer be doubted, the magnitude of consequences, and most especially for health, can still be reduced. Consideration of the health impact of climate change can help political leaders move with appropriate urgency. The core concern is succinctly stated: climate change endangers health in fundamental ways. The warming of the planet will be gradual, but the effects of extreme weather events, more storms, floods, droughts, and heat waves, will be abrupt and acutely felt. Both trends can affect some of the most fundamental determinants of health: air, water, food, shelter, and freedom from disease. Although climate change is a global phenomenon, its consequences will not be evenly distributed. Scientists agree that developing countries and small island nations will be the first and hardest hit. WHO has identified five major health consequences of climate change. First, the agricultural sector is extremely sensitive to climate variability. Increases in malnutrition are expected to be especially severe in countries where large populations depend on rain-fed subsistence farming. Second, more frequent extreme weather events mean more potential deaths and injuries caused by storms and floods. In addition, flooding can be followed by outbreaks of diseases such as cholera, especially when water and sanitation services are damaged or destroyed. Third, both scarcities of water, which is essential for hygiene, and excess water due to more frequent and torrential rainfall will increase the burden of diarrheal diseases, which are spread through contaminated food and water. Fourth, heat waves, especially in urban, quote-unquote, heat islands, can directly increase morbidity and mortality, mainly in elderly people with cardiovascular or respiratory disease. Finally, changing temperatures and patterns of rainfall are expected to alter the geographical distribution of insect vectors that spread infectious diseases. Of these diseases, malaria and dengue are of greatest public health concern. In short, climate change can affect problems that are already huge, largely concentrated in the developing world, and difficult to combat. Citizens, too, need to be fully informed of the health issues. In the end, it is their concerns that can spur policymakers to take the right actions urgently. Dr. Barry Zevin is a primary care physician and former medical director at Tom Waddell Health Center. I spoke with him in his office in San Francisco. Dr. Zevin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me out of your busy schedule. I really appreciate the opportunity to learn about your work. Can you tell me how you came into practicing addiction medicine?
For the past 20 years, I've been doing healthcare for the homeless work. I'm a general internist by training and really buy into the primary care model of doing continuity care. Well, over a period of years, it became clear that I was developing a specialty in treating people who were using substances. There's a way to get a more complete training or knowledge base. So I did the certification from American Society of Addiction Medicine.
What has been your experience practicing addiction medicine?
It's really been very, very interesting. Now, quite specifically, some of the things that have come along that have been very remarkable. One of them is prescribing buprenorphine for heroin or other opioid dependence. In the past, we have had available non-medication treatment, which no matter what the treatment is, the outcomes have not been very good. We know that of people with opioid dependence who are not treated with some sort of opioid maintenance therapy, 80% or more of those people will relapse. That's a medical fact that's biologically determined. So we had methadone maintenance, which is very highly regulated in America. It's actually illegal to prescribe methadone or any other opioid, with the exception of buprenorphine, for the treatment of opiate dependence outside of a licensed and registered narcotic treatment program, which is required to comply with a boatload of federal and state regulations. Every aspect of that is regulated. What patients are offered, which is frequently life-saving treatment.
What do you mean by it's life-saving?
For most people with opioid dependence, being on methadone or buprenorphine or another maintenance treatment is the only way. And frankly, being a heroin addict is life-threatening every day, whether that's from being at risk of catching infectious diseases or overdose. Life expectancy of a heroin addict is not too great. Giving something that will actually treat that and take that problem from being a street problem to being a medical situation that's controlled is definitely life-saving. Buprenorphine is much more in the realm of something that we can do in the course of a regular medical practice. For a lot of our patients, especially a lot of our homeless patients, patients with co-occurring severe mental health disorders, all of the requirements that come with a methadone maintenance program, people have not been able to do and have therefore not been able to have access to that treatment. It used to be that when somebody with heroin addiction came to my clinic, there's very little I had to offer. We could offer a non-opiate kind of detox, clonidine and other medicines, to make it a little easier for them to withdraw. Mostly that didn't work. We could offer them, well, you can go to this methadone maintenance program. It's somewhere else. It's outside of my clinic. It's something that I don't have any control of as your primary care doctor. And that's about it. now with buprenorphine, we can offer people the buprenorphine completely wrapped together with their primary care so we can deal with all of their chronic medical problems. Most of my patients have chronic hepatitis C. Many of my patients have HIV and AIDS. Many of my patients have co-occurring mental health disorders and a whole range of other kinds of health problems. And patients come back and say they can't believe how well this works and their lives are changed because they don't have to go and get heroin several times a day and they are able to start to work on getting healthier. What's challenging is, okay, now we have a medicine that works for many people. It's rather expensive. We have a program in San Francisco where we can provide free medicines for people. That's been great, but it's always a limited number of patients. Often the first month they come in and say, this is miraculous. I have been using heroin for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, never found anything that worked. And here's this stuff. And I take it once a day and I don't have a craving. I don't even think about using heroin. Beyond just the physical, it seems to people that it changes the psychology. As people are on it for a period of time, all that person's other problems, this pill didn't fix them. Problems in the psychological and psychiatric area, in the social area, in the spiritual area, the area of what has happened in terms of the meaning in somebody's life, we really need to be able to work on those and address those. And that's the real challenge. The problems that people had before they started using drugs did not take those problems away and often magnified them. And the problems that people have gotten from years of using drugs in a society where drug use is so stigmatized and so shameful, so much problems with the criminal justice system, so much trauma and losses for people to start to recover, those are the issues that we need to work with. And we work as a multidisciplinary team, counselors and nursing staff and others. The medical treatment probably does need to come first. And for a whole lot of people, the conventional ways of addressing the issues, go to an AA meeting, go to an NA meeting, go to a program, they're a little too much for many people. Anything that claims to work for everyone doesn't work for everyone. Again, many of my patients are the most severely affected people who you'll see in society, people who, because of these problems, have had chronic long-term homelessness, multiple traumas, losses. Often people have some degree of brain damage from things that have occurred from using drugs and alcohol or from having trauma to their head.
Have you seen any cases where buprenorphine has not helped?
Sure. There's a certain amount of readiness for treatment. And I don't mean that the way that people often say, well, you've got to come asking for treatment, you've got to be ready, you've got to hit bottom. But to some extent, people do need to be at the right place in the right time. And one of the things that I think is powerful about being a primary care doctor is you get to work with people over a long time. And if they're not ready, the stars aren't aligned right for them to do the buprenorphine this month, maybe it will be next month or next year. And I've certainly had a few people who've had two or three false starts. Yeah, I'm ready. And then they never kept their follow-up appointment. Yeah, I'm ready. And they took it for a day. And then they were arrested and they were incarcerated for a year. There's a couple other scenarios. Buprenorphine does have a ceiling effect. So people with a very high level of tolerance who are using very high levels of opioids may not get complete relief of withdrawal symptoms. And some of those people we need to treat with methadone and then gradually taper the methadone down and then switch them to buprenorphine. The most common thing that people say about buprenorphine is, I take it and I feel normal. I don't feel loaded, I don't feel stoned, I don't feel altered, and most people really like that. But a certain number of patients say, you know, I can't tolerate feeling not under the influence. The traumas in my life are overwhelming to me. I need something to numb me out. Now, there are other ways of managing those feelings, none of them easy. I should mention that people with chronic pain who require opiate medication, buprenorphine probably isn't the best choice. Somebody who's using buprenorphine who tries to use other opiates generally won't feel it. That's the buprenorphine story, and it has changed my practice in terms of working with heroin addicts.
Can you explain what the difference is between methadone and buprenorphine and why one is so highly regulated and the other one is not?
Buprenorphine and methadone are the best thing we have for any of our addiction problems. I don't think that gets said enough because people look at these and say, well, isn't this just another drug? Isn't this just another kind of addiction? And the fact of the matter is that this is medication treating a very specific kind of medical problem. Technically, buprenorphine is a partial agonist and methadone is a full agonist at the receptor.
Can you explain to our listeners what an agonist means?
Yeah. Buprenorphine works only partially, which means that at a certain point, it stops having an effect on that receptor, what we call ceiling effect. Methadone has a full effect, which means that the more you take of it, the more effect it has, and it can be mildly sedating to a severely sedating to an effect that can be an overdose and cause unconsciousness to an effect that can be fatal. Buprenorphine generally doesn't go into those unconsciousness, stop breathing level.
And you don't get the high at all from either of them?
You probably can get some effect, but they both don't have a rush associated with it.
And you mentioned that buprenorphine was a lot like naloxone.
Buprenorphine does have a blocking effect on other opiates. Buprenorphine wants to be in and stay in that receptor more than anything else. Methadone has less of that blocking effect. Another drug that has been used to treat opiate dependence is naltrexone, which turns out to have a lot of use in treating alcohol dependence. And what it does is it blocks the opiate receptors, but doesn't cause any effect on them at all. While the idea is good, gee, take this medicine, and even if you tried to use heroin or another medicine, you wouldn't feel it. For most people, it doesn't work that way. People might take it for a while and then start to have craving. Then they stop taking their naltrexone and start using. Buprenorphine and methadone take away the craving.
Partly because they also kind of activate the receptor. There's a partial activation and a partial blocking.
Correct.
Our brains are producing endorphins, which are like opiates, and we need a certain amount of that pleasure sensation to have a fulfilling life.
We are producing endorphins, and one theory of why people become addicted and then dependent upon opioids and why relapse is so common is that either the endogenous endorphin system is broken in some way, or the receptors are broken in some way and don't respond to the endogenous endorphins. Somebody with heroin addiction, their brains are actually different. It's very easy to say, well, why can't these people just stop doing drugs? This actually is a biological, neurochemical phenomenon. So much of the behavioral and psychological stuff evaporates quickly when people have been on buprenorphine. It has made me think more in terms of the biological.
Why is buprenorphine not as highly regulated as methadone?
Mostly that's political. In other places around the world, methadone is also used in the more ordinary practice of medicine. Buprenorphine has a ceiling effect. People are less likely to have a fatal overdose is one important thing. The fact that it's co-formulated with naloxone so that it's not likely to be diverted.
What does that mean, co-formulated?
When you get a tablet of Suboxone, it contains a dose of buprenorphine, and it contains a dose of naloxone. The brand name of that is Narcan, and it's what we give to people to reverse them from having an overdose. But Narcan is only absorbed if you inject it. The drug company and the regulators very cleverly came up with this idea that if you use it as directed, which is dissolving it under your tongue, you get all the buprenorphine, but none of the Narcan. But if you try and inject it, you're going to get the Narcan. And that's going to make you sick. Not only does it block the receptor, but it's going to knock all of the other stuff off it.
So you'll go through acute withdrawal.
Correct. Now, in other parts of the world, buprenorphine is a frequently abused drug. It's not co-formulated with the naloxone. And that's been a problem in India, and it's been a problem in the former Soviet Union.
Do you have a philosophy in treating patients with addiction problems?
We all have a philosophy, whether we know it or not. I like to talk about a biopsychosocial spiritual model. Healthcare for the homeless and doing addiction medicine has really made clear to me is that there's a spiritual aspect. It's very important for people to have meaning in their life, experience in their life that transcends day-to-day existence. To say to somebody, if you would stop using drugs, you'd be healthier. Why should I be healthier? As soon as you ask the question, why should I be healthier, you're out of the realm of the biological, you're somewhat in the realm of the psychosocial, but even more so, you're in the realm of what, by shorthand, I will call the spiritual. And I think particularly for many of the patients who I see, whose lives have become narrowed down and coned down to this very rough struggle for existence, being able to say, well, bring into it meaning and of transcending this day-to-day existence really becomes very, very important for any kind of change to happen. The other informing philosophy that I have is of a harm reduction philosophy. It starts with the idea recovery is impossible if you're deceased. The idea of harm reduction is that we work with people on a one-on-one basis. We realize that people don't change all at once, and they may be able to change something in a small way before they're able to change something in a big way. If people are continuing to use drugs, we can assist them by helping them continue to use drugs in the safest possible way. Often somebody's goal is not, I'm going to stop using. People have a whole range of goals. Starting with goals that we mutually share is kind of at the core of harm reduction. For many people, the personal autonomy in a life that in many ways has lost control is very essential. In some ways, it's the last thing that people have. As soon as you say, stop using drugs, you have created very severe limits on what kind of helpful relationship you can have with somebody is.
It also seems like it would be really challenging.
It's challenging. I also find it very fulfilling. As a physician, the way I spend my time with patients has changed in some ways. I spend more time listening to people than I do talking to people. I certainly spend more time trying to get at what people's lives are like and what people's hopes are and what people's goals are. I count on having a long-term experience with my patients. And just being there to witness people's lives and sometimes feeling like I may be the only person who can hold that memory of that person, that's also a very meaningful thing.
Beautiful. I have one more question about the rising incidence of people coming to physicians and using prescription medications.
Prescription drug abuse and diversion is a big problem. It's more of a problem for physicians because of this deeply emotional issue of feeling like your trust has been betrayed. Clearly, we worry about, are we going to get in trouble with the medical board or the DEA? And are we doing the right thing? And are we doing harm to our patients? And all that is really meaningful. But somebody coming in and lying to us and betraying our trust is really hard to deal with.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
My father's a doctor. When he found out what kind of work I was going to be doing, he said, well, that's really very altruistic of you, but you should not expect to get much gratefulness. I have never found that to be the case. My patients are continuously grateful to me, often for things that seem trivial, and I get thanks every day, and it's a privilege to do this.
Well, I want to thank you for your work, your skill, your knowledge, your compassion, and your time.
You're welcome.
Dr. Barry Zevin, primary care physician and addiction medicine specialist at Tom Waddell Health Center in San Francisco. Tin tin na di na ta mta mta ki ta ta mte te ka ta ga di ga na te te ka ta ga di ga na ta ki ta ta te te ka ta ga di ga na ta ki ta ta te te ka ta ga di ga na ta a ki ta. Fred Oler King is an acupuncturist at Hennepin Faculty Associates Addiction Medicine Program. He has 20 years of experience working as a counselor in the field of addictions. I spoke with him in his home in Minneapolis. Fred, thank you so much for taking this time to talk to me.
Absolutely. It's nice to have you here.
You're an acupuncturist.
I'm an acupuncturist. I work in a free clinic that is part of an addiction medicine program. We do acupuncture 4 days a week for people in the community that are dealing with mental health or chemical health issues. It was originally started by a woman named Pat Culleton, who was a big influence in the formation of NADA, which is the National Acupuncture Detox Association, which is an organization that sort of initiated and popularized the five-point protocol, which is a ear acupuncture treatment for people that are dealing with chemical dependency issues. And it's, since then, it's been expanded to treat people that are under dealing with stress and trauma. It was used with great success in New York post 9/11 and in New Orleans after Katrina. There's a group called Acupuncture Without Borders that has kind of expanded this to a lot of different places.
Wow.
You know, there's also another group called the Community Acupuncture Network. Skip and Lisa, they're in a clinic in Portland, Oregon called Working Class Acupuncture. And they started this organization of people providing low-cost, affordable acupuncture to people in the community in a group setting. They do more a classical approach to acupuncture in that they do most of the needling, what are called the antique points, and these are the points on the body that extend from the elbow to the tip of the hand or from the knee down to the leg, points on the head, which are oftentimes considered to be the most powerful points on the body. They're able to treat almost every disorder that one would normally treat with acupuncture. It's basically what people would pay as a copay to see their regular physician, anywhere from $20 to $30. It's not charity. It doesn't rely on outside support. It doesn't rely on insurance, and it doesn't rely on the government. It's basically people taking care of themselves, and it's really grown. It's spread across the country. The clinic in Portland really grew through the support of their patients. Here they're getting something that provided them with a service that they really need when oftentimes the rest of the medical community had basically turned their backs on them. You know, I don't want to make that sound harsh, but just simply because of the way our current medical structure is that, you know, we're relying on insurance, and I'm sorry, insurance is evil.
Well, their motive is profit.
Their motive is profit, and it isn't healing. And until that changes, we've got to find other ways of providing that care.
So the Community Acupuncture Network isn't primarily for people who are suffering from addictions. It's just for anybody.
Absolutely, for anybody. You name it, they can treat it.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
This clinic that you work at, the whole thing is a free clinic?
The acupuncture clinic is free, and we're primarily pharmaceutically based. It's a methadone program, and then we also, for alcohol treatment, we have an antabuse program, naltrexone, and a caprasate. And our director made the commitment to help provide this additional service by providing acupuncture. Some of our patients are probably homeless, and we have a few that are well-established in their recovery, working, you know, living independently, getting on with their lives, and they simply come in to see us because we've been helpful to them and they want to continue with these services to help support their sobriety.
Okay, that's interesting. That's unusual, actually.
Yeah, I think it is. The clinic where this was originally developed is in the Bronx. A physician named Michael Smith started this protocol there, treating patients that were going through a methadone detox to help deal with the withdrawal symptoms once the taper was finished. And the protocol was originally developed by a physician in Hong Kong, Dr. Wen. It was brought to the Bronx, and then from there it kind of grew, and about 10 years later, in the mid-80s, the NADA organization was founded, and then that kind of proceeded to spread it across the country. You know, you have these patients that have dealt with extreme trauma. They come in and they don't want to talk. They don't want to do counseling, but they need something to help them become grounded, something to find their center again because they've been so scattered. And this is an opportunity to do that in a quiet space that feels secure without using medication, without having to talk through the process. Although that, you know, at some point that may be important to them, but oftentimes they're very resistant to it initially.
How do we know about the effectiveness? Have there been some randomized double-blind controlled trials or just post-treatment surveys? Or what's the story on that?
The big thing, I think, is really talking to people that have experienced it. You know, it's not something that maybe everybody's going to react to, but there are those people that come in and it is exactly what they need. You treat them, and to have them then tell you, wow, that changed my experience, it helped me so much. That's really all I need to know that it's helping.
Often these modalities are very practitioner dependent, and so they can't be standardized in the same way that pharmaceuticals can be.
I think there's real truth to that. You know, so much about the healing relationship, it's about searching for somebody that you connect with and that can help you. Sometimes it's not even about the technique, it's about the relationship. You know, by having a good relationship with a practitioner, you open yourself up to change.
Can you tell me about the five-point technique?
The idea behind ear acupuncture or auricular acupuncture is that throughout the body, there are microcosms. You can treat the entire body by using points on the ear. If you're familiar with reflexology, the same concept works with the foot, or Korean acupuncture, where you can treat the entire body with the hand. And the points that are used in the what we call the NADA protocol or the five-point protocol are Shen Men. The spirit gate is to calm the spirit, and the sympathetic point is to help reestablish equilibrium in the body. And the kidney point, the liver point, and the lung point. Those points are chosen because they're kind of the core of what we're trying to do, which is to particularly support the yin of the body, which is the calming energy, the building energy of the body.
You can use those 5 points for anybody across the board who's having withdrawal from any drug or is having either acute or chronic stress reaction to any kind of trauma.
Right. This is a very basic protocol that most people will respond to. It's very good at calming the body. In our clinic, we do the 5-point protocol, and then we'll use additional needles to treat other issues. The original concept behind NADA was to provide non-acupuncturists with a protocol that they could use with a minimal amount of training. You make this powerful technique available to a lot more people.
So depending on the state, I, as an allopathic physician, could learn these 5 points and obtain the same effect. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. You know, acupuncture is a really powerful technique. People can do things with a limited amount of training, but I believe that with greater training, you provide more services to your patient.
Can you tell me about the traditional Chinese medicine philosophy or approach to how habits develop?
At the core of Chinese medicine is qi. Everything is energy. Movement is energy, and we are energy. We're qi manifest. The next step out is yin and yang. We live when we're in balance. We move when we're in balance. And that anything that disrupts that balance between yin and yang sets the system moving in an unhealthy direction. In Chinese medicine, there's the prenatal qi. That can be the concept that we're born with a certain potential. You know, when we think of that in Western thought, we think of that as our genetic potential. Some people get lucky on that draw, and some people don't. The person that's born with less of that has a weaker system and is more susceptible to outside influence. And the outside influences can be things of, you know, emotions that are damaging, incorrect consumption of foods, alcohol, trauma. And so once the system gets out of balance, the person oftentimes makes poor choices about how to reestablish that balance. Then we get into a cycle that perpetuates a system out of order. Finding the balance is the challenge. Using drugs makes you feel good for the moment, but you know, ultimately you're still pushing a system that's out of balance further out of balance.
Once they're out of balance, they get into a vicious cycle. Treatment is an attempt to start a virtuous cycle.
Exactly. It's very well said. That is really the core of all treatment within Chinese medicine.
Can you tell me a little bit about your experience?
Well, I started off working in a tobacco cessation study. And then from there, I worked in a research study looking at a medication to treat cocaine dependence. It was a placebo-controlled double-blind study using carbamazepine, which is an anti-seizure medication. Tegretol. From there, I worked at the university in a research study treating sex offenders, doing a comparison between Prozac and Provera. The idea behind that is basically the thought of chemical castration. The doctor that I was working with, his idea with this was, is that Prozac is far better at suppressing people's sex drive with fewer side effects than Provera. It was a difficult study because it was hard to recruit patients.
What was the outcome?
Well, we never had a high enough enrollment to really get any sort of statistical significance.
So the question still remains.
The question still remains. My experience with patients that have been on Prozac, Prozac's really effective at suppressing sex drive.
How about acupuncture?
You know, that's a good question. You know, I think that by providing people a calm, safe space, they can begin to examine their issues. You know, my personal feeling about this is that it is an adjunct to treatment. Acupuncture in itself is not sufficient to change somebody's behavior. What we can do is we can support them in that process. We can help give them the energy so that they can begin to approach this problem, because it requires a lot of energy from inside to change these things. But really, ultimately, it comes from within, and it comes from people being motivated to change.
And also you can help with the withdrawal process.
Right. Diminish their symptoms, help them feel calm, and to deal with some of the anxiety that oftentimes is part of the thing that pushed them towards using drugs in the first place. The depression, the anxiety, the trauma.
The pain.
The pain, exactly. Both physical and emotional. Mm-hmm. So to continue with the history, and then I also worked in a group dealing with patients that were dealing with sexual compulsivity, or as some people refer to it, sexual addiction. And this was a support group for primarily for men, but there were some women also involved. Their sexual behaviors had gotten out of control, multiple relationships, pornography.
Risky behavior.
Risky behavior, yeah, absolutely. All sorts of sexual behavior that ultimately led these people to lose a lot of the things that were important to them.
Tell me about that work.
That work was really rewarding. We provided ongoing weekly support groups to talk about their behaviors, to analyze what was it that was driving them to seek this sort of solace, to support them in changing that habit. There's always an issue of withdrawing from the behavior. Oftentimes, that behavior has provided great comfort. Granted, it comes at a great cost. You take that away, and there's a lot of pain to deal with. So having someone there to walk with you through that process is really important. If you think about sexual compulsivity within the kind of the Western conceptualization of addiction, you know, you can really see how that initiates the reward system. When I think about an addiction, I really think about a compulsive behavior that is engaged in despite consequences. Sometimes what happens, I'm thinking about people in recovery, they become, with great reason, very fearful of returning to their old behaviors. And so that they become, from the outside perspective, they become rigid in what they're willing to participate in and what they need to do to maintain that sobriety. A lot of times in those situations, they haven't learned the skill of how to bring pleasure to themselves. Some of that skill is about how you think about life and how to find pleasure despite the fact that we also experience pain. And some people obviously have so much more pain, but there is a skill that people need to learn about being able to, even in the midst of suffering, to see what there is to enjoy. There's always something to enjoy, and it's where we choose to put our focus.
That's really beautiful. Well said.
Thank you.
Continue from where we diverted.
We diverted from the program in human sexuality. And from there, I went to work at the addiction medicine program and started off there as a counselor working primarily with methadone patients. That is a really interesting environment for a counselor or a therapist to be in, because you are not just your patient's therapist, you're also your patient's policeman. You're working with a medication that is extremely controlled, and there are very strict regulations about when it can be dispensed, who it can be given to, how often they need to be seen. It puts a therapist in a difficult position. You are always balancing those two roles with the patient, and the patient is well aware of it. There's a much greater power differential. You have a great control over a patient's life when you control when they get their medication and how often they can get it and the amount of freedom they have in accessing it, whether or not they have to come into the clinic 6 days a week or they have to come into the clinic 1 day a week or 1 day a month. Oftentimes, by the time people show up in a methadone program, they've gone through additional treatments that hasn't worked. They've been in great amount of trouble, legal, family, medical, and their lives are so disrupted and so disorganized and so out of balance that it takes great effort to reestablish that.
Tell me about your experience using acupuncture and Chinese medicine.
Like I said, one of the great things about it for me has been the contrast from my role with the patients before, because I'm working with some of the same patients that I knew when I was doing direct counseling. At the end of the treatment, patients telling me, oh, I feel better, I feel more relaxed, oh, I'm so glad I could get in today. To be useful to someone, to help them with something is, you know, for me, it's so rewarding. You want to talk about a dopamine rush. For me, that's the deal.
So you're addicted to treating patients.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they don't even have to say thank you. They just have to say, oh, I feel better. And I'm like, okay, great. Originally got interested in acupuncture and saw how effective it was. And I was just blown away. You know, how could somebody stick a needle, you know, on the top of my head and a few points on my body? And it was like somebody gave me 10 milligrams of Valium. Wow. Okay, we need more of this and less of the Valium.
We should have government-issued needles for the 5 points in the ear for everybody, because our whole society could use a little calming down.
Yeah, absolutely. We lead such hectic and unbalanced lives. Having an opportunity to slow down, stop, and rebalance is really, really important.
Do you have any clinical anecdotes you'd like to share?
One of the things I love about this is I really am a big believer in the idea of people getting treated together. There is something that happens when people are in a room together seeking the same goal. It's so much more powerful. A friend of mine talked about the analogy of, you know, going to a sporting event. I mean, you watch a game on TV by yourself and, well, it's, you know, it's a game on TV, but to be in the stadium with everyone, that's an entirely different experience. Or for people that are familiar with meditation, you know, meditating by yourself at home is one thing, but to meditate in a group for me is just a profoundly different experience, you know, and also for people that participate in churches, you know, to pray at home or to pray in the church is a very different experience. So this idea that when we come together and we're seeking the same goal, that it is so much easier to attain it, even if we're seeking it on our own path.
It's like group therapy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to add about Chinese medicine, acupuncture, your experience with working with patients with addictions?
The key in this is providing the greatest amount of care to the greatest number of people. There are so many different modalities: Ayurvedic medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, Western medicine, homeopathy, reflexology, massage therapy. There are so many ways for people to heal. We may have a different language, but ultimately we're really talking about the same thing. Each of us has our own different techniques that we've found helpful and effective. You know, we've got so much to learn from each other.
We're all trying to help people.
Exactly.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been really a great pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you came by.
Fred Olerking, acupuncturist at Hennepin Faculty Associates Addiction Medicine Program in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Tin tin na di na tete ka ta ga di gene ta m tete ka ta ga di gene ta tete ka ta ga di gene ta tete ka ta ga di gene ta tete ka ta ga di gene ta. Jay Erker is an artist and yogini aspirant. I spoke to her after a yoga class one day. Do you have any habits or addictions that you'd be willing to share your story about?
Oh, yeah, I have a few. One addiction that has greatly defined my life is I used to smoke. I've dabbled in every drug, but I've never been addicted to any drug other than tobacco. I was born into a family, both parents smoked, chain smoked. My sister first gave me my first cigarette when I was 11. She was 4 years older than me. But I didn't smoke consistently. You know, my friends and I would catch a drag or a cigarette here and there throughout middle school and high school. But it wasn't anything that I really started to do until I was 18. I'm 34 now. I quit smoking 2.5 years ago, January 1st, 2005.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm still very much addicted to it. I still have the cravings. It's created other addictions to take its place.
Do you remember your first puff of cigarette?
I do.
Can you describe it?
I was with my sister and her friend, Kelly, and I think we were in the woods near the house or something, and it was very familiar. You know, like I said, my parents chain smoked, and the smell was always around me, and it felt really good. I didn't cough, you know, as you see people coughing in the movies or whatever, and I didn't reject the taste. It had a lot of appeal, you know, socially, everyone who's cool smokes. That's the way I saw it when I was that age. I felt really cool doing it. I mean, I felt really nervous because I was 11 years old and I was nervous anytime I did any kind of so-called bad thing.
What about the heat and the smoke, the actual smoke going into your mouth and lungs? Do you remember that?
I don't think I knew how to inhale it properly. So I remember the taste more. And I do remember it going into the throat a little bit. And I remember the smells around me and the psychological atmosphere at the time, and it was very exciting.
Did your parents find out?
No.
When did they find out that you were smoking?
I think I was 19 years old. I was going to community college. I was still living at home. They both smoked, so it was very easy to smoke and them not know. You know, if they were non-smokers, it would have been a lot harder. because they'd be able to smell it. But how they found out is I was driving down the street in my neighborhood with my boyfriend at the time. We lit up as soon as we got down the street away from the house, and that was all about it as well. And I remember seeing my mother driving from the opposite direction, and I was taking a drag off my cigarette, and our eyes met. And then that's when I, you know, muttered a few expletives and said, I'm in trouble.
How did your parents react?
My mom was very disappointed in me. I remember the confrontation in the front lawn. I was the baby, and she had high expectations of me. You know, it wasn't personal towards her. I think parents take it that way. And she felt very deceived and thought I was a lot better than that. She didn't yell at me, which is kind of odd for my mother. She's a yeller. I felt bad, too, for deceiving her.
So it was more the deception rather than the actual fact of you smoking.
Yeah, she didn't play any double standards on that. She doesn't want me to smoke, but I mean, sort of like do what you want them to do. Show it in your actions how you want your children to be, and they weren't necessarily showing me, and I don't think she necessarily blamed me for smoking because of that. You know, she isn't a great role model. But, you know, she reiterated the fact that, you know, it's bad for you and da-da-da-da.
Do you think your addiction to smoking is inherited genetically or through the culture of your family?
I think some kind of addiction runs in my family genetically. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. He quit drinking, I think, when his children began to be born. But he was also addicted to smoking and caffeine. You know, I'm not addicted to alcohol. I never have been. You know, I used to be a strong social drinker. I could see the shape of the addiction if I wanted to, but I didn't want to. The cigarette addiction was bolstered from the environment I grew up in. I remember going to elementary school, I think it was like fourth grade or something like that, and my teachers confronting me, asking me if I smoked. That's how much the smoke hung on my clothes. They thought I smoked.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it's shocking. You know, and I'm this little kid and terribly innocent, not knowing what's going on. And my dad had two jobs. He worked throughout the night and during the day. He was able to sleep only from like 9 o'clock in the morning to like 12 in the afternoon. So he would get home from work at like 8:30 in the morning, and he'd sit there chain smoking and reading the newspaper as I was getting ready to go to school. I could see with my childhood eyes right now and the dull light of the kitchen in the morning, you know, and seeing the smoke wafting and hanging in the air. And I could see it, you know, moving into the living room. It's crazy how clear I'm seeing this right now. It was really bad.
Do you think you would have become a smoker or would have tried smoking if your parents didn't smoke or if your sister didn't smoke?
I think I would have. I think it's an inherent part of my personality to do things I'm not supposed to do.
To be the rebel.
Yeah, I mean, I really have this urge to break the rules.
Can you talk about your experience quitting smoking?
Yeah, I quit many times, like most people who've quit. The most I lasted in all those was like a month. You know, having quit so long now, 2.5 years, I think I understand what it took, and that was the will. Your will had to overcome the addiction. Your will had to overcome the urge and the compulsion. All those previous times, it wasn't strong enough. I didn't want to. I mean, to this day, I could say I love smoking. I really do. I love the taste of it. I love it going through my mouth. It's very tactile. It's very... This is going to sound like a commercial. It's really great feeling of this, like, this smoke going through your throat and feeling it caress the inside of your throat and then inhaling, and you're like, and you just breathe it in and it fills your lungs, and then you exhale and you could feel it come out. Okay, granted, there's a strong neurological addiction that's been set up, you know, with the chemicals, but it's a ritual. There's so much going on besides that.
So what was it that made you want to quit smoking if you loved it so much?
That's a very good question. Well, I mean, I knew I had to. I knew that the body can't sustain that kind of smoking. And I knew at some point I had to quit. When I was younger, in my early 20s, I said I was going to quit when I was 30. And that'd be that. And 30 came and went. I put it in the back of my mind saying, okay, you need to do it. And you need to cultivate the atmosphere in which you can do it. I kind of cultivated the negative feelings towards it more than the positive ones. I don't like the smell of other people smoking. I don't like the smell of it on my body. My instinctual reaction is aversion. You know, in the back of my mind, I kept building it up. All of my negativity towards smoking. And living in the Bay Area also helps because you seem anathema to everybody. Everyone looks at you like you're the bad guy, and you feel like such a jerk whenever you light up. You really do. You just feel so alienated and alone.
So very cultural.
Yeah, it was social for sure. I moved to California when I was in my late 20s to go to school. And school isn't a good environment to quit smoking because all the kids smoke. And I lived in L.A., and a lot of people smoke in L.A. A lot of people don't, too, but, you know. But the Bay Area, forget it. You're an alien.
What is it about the Bay Area?
Number one, I think it's health. But number two, I think it's political. I am very familiar with the political ramifications of smoking and the companies that are involved in it. So that was also actually more fuel to my fire.
So what I understand is that you took your attention and focus towards the negative impact of smoking on your health and on your life. How were you able to actually cultivate the capacity to choose where to put your focus?
When I began to cultivate and focus on the negative aspects of smoking, I was doing yoga quite a lot. When I first started yoga, I began seeing a change in, of course, my body, my physique. I also began to feel a change psychologically in my outlook on life. And suddenly, my body was asking me to change my lifestyle. I was smoking at the time I started doing yoga. And it was during that time when I upped the amount of time I did yoga per week that I began feeling a stronger urge. I'd felt it before, but, you know, it was easily ignored.
A stronger urge for what?
A stronger urge to change the negative habits of my lifestyle. I would go to yoga, and as soon as I'd come out, I'd light up. And it felt really good because you're doing all the breathing exercises and your lungs are hyperexpanded. And then you take that drag and it felt really, it was just great. But at the same time as I take that drag, I felt this profound sense of guilt, let alone the fact that I knew that people could smell it on me in class and, you know, they'd give me the evil eye. And I felt like a jerk, and I felt like a jerk to myself in the end. That's the bottom line. It was just these subtle energies. And my body was saying, you need to quit smoking. My addiction was stronger than it at the time. It became a battle against my body or this urge to stop and then the addiction. And it was so palpable. I could feel the conflict in me. And it became so bad. It was like, okay, it's either smoking or yoga. You're in a Western. It was noon. High noon. You know, you're on this one-way street and you got your holster. And it was yoga, and it was smoking. And they were facing off. And at the time, I wasn't strong enough, and smoking won. And I actually stopped doing yoga.
But you came back to yoga.
Yes, I came back to yoga. I was still smoking. The same urges started to well up in me, subtly saying, you need to quit. I felt really guilty about smoking winning that battle. I had a lot of remorse. I had a lot of complicated feelings. And so I was like, okay, you know, I'm not going to let smoking win again. Yoga wants you to be healthy. Crazy. It's like the effect of it, at least, is you. And it says you need to eat better. You need to stop doing these things that harm your body and harm you psychologically as well. You're sort of helpless against that. I mean, granted, smoking won in the first battle, but yoga helped my psychological space be able to be stronger and a belief in yourself physically and spiritually, emotionally.
When you're spinning in an addiction, it's like a vicious cycle. And practicing yoga is a way of setting up a virtuous cycle. The good news is that in your case, virtue prevailed. And virtuous just means that healthy habits promote healthier habits. Happiness brings forth more happiness.
Yes. You know, that's a really good way of characterizing the subtle nudging that my body was giving me.
You've quit smoking, and now you've replaced it with some other addictions.
The quitting left a gaping hole in my psyche. I felt very empty. What happens is when you're smoking, it brings meaning to your life. It's actually the meaning to your life. The thought of quitting depressed me terribly. You actually had thoughts that your life was not worth living. That's what brought you to the next half hour, to the next hour, that looking forward to that moment when you could just sit there and have your quiet time, have your cigarette, and just inhale. When I quit, I didn't have that anymore, and it was very depressing. You needed to fill that hole that the addiction had left. The easiest thing was food. I am now addicted to sweets. I like cookies, cakes, ice cream, you name it, I like it. I know I'm addicted to it because I can't stop. I actually want a healthy lifestyle, and I've been trying to do that for a while now, and I haven't been able to because of the snacking.
Anything else besides sweets?
Yeah. Shopping, consumerism. I'm not a rich person. My husband and I have recently come into jobs that allow us to have a little extra money. Granted, I don't overspend. You could say that I do because we want to save and we haven't been able to save. I don't buy huge things, but little small things here and there, things I don't necessarily need. I really feel the smoking addiction left this gaping hole that needs to be filled, and I'm filling it with the sweets and the shopping. Hopefully, that'll be almost like killing two birds with one stone, because if I stop eating the snacks, I'm saving money.
Do you have a plan on how you're going to do it?
Yeah. It has everything to do with being conscious in the moment. I forget that I'm trying to stop whatever it is I'm doing. The desire to enjoy it, to fill the hole, is stronger than my willpower to stop. Addiction, no matter what it looks like, it's the same animal. Granted, I don't know what it's like to be a heroin addict. I've heard heroin addicts speak, and it sounds very similar to my experience with smoking. When you're having a hard time in your life, and maybe you don't have a good support system, it's like you just turn to whatever it is will make you feel better, you know, despite its adverse reactions to your lifestyle, your health, your well-being.
It's the mind seeking pleasure.
It's true. That's a true statement for sure. But it has to do with your soul on some level. It's not the mind. It's just your sense of well-being. It just wants that emptiness to go away. And these things do it. Granted, it's fleeting. That's why you have to keep going back.
Well said. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Perhaps everyone who's listening, that you can do it. You need to have confidence. And you need to have the willpower and strength. There is a support group out there. You just need to find it. You're never alone. There's always someone out there that's in a similar situation. So either you need to get off your butt and go to a support group, get a book, you know, talk to someone, talk to your friend, talk to someone that you could trust. And therapy, I strongly recommend therapy. You need to find the one that's going to work for you and has you have a good relationship with.
Thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure to talk to you, and you've been very generous with sharing your story.
It's been a profound experience for me to think about it. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to do so. I'm getting teary.
Thank you.
Jay Erker, artist and ex-smoking yogini in the Bay Area.
Tin, tin, na, di, na. Dage tete kata gadi gene ta 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 tete ta tete kata gadi gene ta tete ta tete kata gadi gene ta tete.
Concluding poem. Chasing pink flamingos down an ordinary road, up a desert ocean shore, just at the edge of my focus, fleeing the capacity of my clarity, fleeting like satisfaction.
Naging Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayshree Chandar. Website setup and design, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and Manjira played by Jayasi. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by GC Garcia. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jays Productions. Found at gypsyjays.net. JYPSYJAYS.NET. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org.